and it always came at an opportune time.
Well, certainly a pleasure having you
here.
Oh, it's
my pleasure. You're right.
Your poetry and your music have given pleasure to millions and millions of people for many years, including myself. In fact, I have at home many of your earlier books of poetry, which have been delicately inscribed to me by various wives and lovers.
That's great. That's sensational.
Some of them I keep out of the way for fear that... Current wives and lovers will see those inscriptions, but I've kept those. I've had them for many, many years. I was delighted to have a chance to see your new book. And I was looking at the at the opening here, two pages of
that books, makes me kind of musical.
By Robert McEwen. Two pages of 40-odd books, and this is a really...
And that's a kind of an incomplete list in a way. I mean, those are more, sort of more obvious kinds of things, but it makes me feel old, I'll tell you that.
I don't know if it makes you feel old or does it make you, must make you feel prolific.
Prolific, but I still every day in my life wonder if I'm doing what it is I'm supposed to do or want to do. To that end, I'm not sure if I've even figured that out yet.
What you want to do?
Yeah, I think everybody wants to make a difference in some way, and even though you get letters from people who tell you you've helped or whatever, it doesn't seem to be a big enough difference, and... I don't know, I just think that there's still something I should be doing that I'm not doing it.
Well, perhaps you're talking about some sort of political or social...
Well, not political, I mean, I do a lot of social things. In fact, I was lamenting to a friend of mine recently that I wish there was some way of being involved with social work without having to meet people. I don't mean that in any kind of a strange way other than that most of the organized forms of trying to help people, whether it's charities or whatever they are, there's so much bureaucracy and so much the hassle involved in it. And you keep wondering if how much of it gets down on a one-to-one basis to people. And then the other thing is that for something like 25 years or more than that, I guess, I was touring and traveling all over the world, all over the country, performing and giving concerts and lectures and things. And I think that I'm sort of peopled out. I kind of resisted giving that up. And then once I'd gotten used to it, I wondered to myself, why in the world I'd been going out all these years when I could have been staying home and I hope becoming a better writer and maybe sorting my life out a little bit better.
But, well, I don't know if you could do that. It seems to me, and be as successful in what you've done, it would seem to me that the very fact that you did go out and to do all these things gave you a lot of ammunition with which to work, that you can't do it by sealing yourself off in a room.
Well, I think that's true. On the other hand, you point to someone like the Bronte sister who never saw anything but one little acre or so area of land, who turned out some of the most interesting fiction written by women or men certainly in the history of literature. I do think that for myself, I do have to sort of pat my stomach and rub my head or vice versa. I like being involved in a lot of things. Although as you get older, it seems as though you begin to think about time and you begin to wonder about how little time is left you. I'm 53, but I'm by no means that old, but 53 is a good enough age to begin to have a lot of second thoughts. I look back at what I've done and I can't find a single book I've written that I wouldn't rewrite again from scratch. I don't know of a single song I've done, maybe one or two, but not really. I don't think to myself, gee, the rhyme scheme could have been better there. I played one of my classical pieces, and then I listened to something by Bruckner, and I think, my God, you know, I'm never going to learn how to do it right. So it's a constant problem, and it's a constant responsibility. I think I let go of fewer things now than I ever did before. And I love rewriting, but I hate writing. I mean, I'd like to spend the rest of my life rewriting what I've done, but you just can't do that.
Well, this desire to want to improve your work is nothing unusual. The poet Robert Lowell, nobody could give him a copy of his work because he would look at it again. As he would autograph a book for somebody and he would flip through the pages and he would see a line and he would begin to make adjustments in a book that had been previously published.
Well, as a matter of fact, that's something I guess all poets do have in common. I mean, everybody Even Auden changed all of his things. And for a while, I had the best of all possible worlds because of the unique publishing arrangement I had in the United States. My books weren't published until a year later in Great Britain, which meant that the English version would come out totally different. Then I published a book of prose in this country, and suddenly my books of poetry, it was the other way around, so that whoever got the British edition or the American edition found, in essence, two different books.
But there does come a time to stop and to go on to other things.
Well, I do. I have wonderful editors. This is my last book for Harper & Row, and I've had two terrific editors there, Larry Ashmead and Margaret Wimberger, and they've been very good to me in letting me rewrite and rewrite right up through galley time. I mean, if somebody were to review the galleys of one of my books, they would never be reviewing the book because, I mean, even now, a good third of these things are still works of progress as far as I'm concerned. And yet, this is the closest I've come to finishing a book to my satisfaction. That's this week.
Well, this week. Well, now, of course, you've written prose and poetry and a lot of music, but the music is very close to the poetry, isn't it?
It is, in a way. I think that I think the big love is music. Music is the first love. I mean, I can't function anywhere without music. If I'm home and there's some kind of social engagement involved or something, and it's that as compared to going to the symphony, then I'll do everything possible to get out of whatever engagements there, or whether it involves work or whatever, to make sure I don't miss the concert. Or there's music going 24 hours a day in my home, in every room. The radio's tuned usually to the same public radio station because they play a lot of classical music. Or in my bedroom, I just have different classical things going on. And CD is a great invention for me because you can get so much music on a single CD that I have a kind of CD jukebox, plays 10 CDs without reloading.
You don't haunt Towered Records now.
I do, indeed. In fact, there's a poem in this book called Is There Life After Tower Records, which is one of the longest poems I've ever written. It's about, I don't know, it's 30 or 40 stanzas. And it's not so much about Tower Records as it is the Tower Records syndrome of that being sort of the new singles bar of the 80s. I'm astounded, whether I'm in Tokyo or London or New York City where they have two towers, or Los Angeles where they have three or four scattered all over the LA County area. You go in and you see singles there sort of glancing furtively across the Rachmaninoff bin to the Berlioz bin and beyond. And as I mentioned in the poem, the people who hunt the cutout section are different from those who go for the Angel Red Line or the RCA Maroon section. It's very strange. They even have a pecking order there. So to that end, I think it would be interesting. At some point, I probably shouldn't have done that as a poem. I should have done it as a novel because the dramas I see acted out there. And in L.A., when friends of mine don't know where to reach me, they call the West Los Angeles branch of Tower, which is the nearest one to my home.
And have you paid?
It's like an office, right? Exactly. And from in the classical section of Tower, folks.
Well, of course, I'm not as fanatical about it as you are, but if I happen to be within a two-block radius of Tower Records, I stop in to see what's going on.
Right.
You really have to. Well, I was looking over the biographical material that Harper and Row included, as well as a couple of pages of biographical material in the back of the book. And, of course, you have written personally about yourself, the book that you wrote, Finding My Father. But you have never done a biography as such, have you?
Not really. I've thought about doing a biography, and I suppose at this point I will. The reason being that every time I pick up a biography of somebody I know, for instance, I find the problem is that in some cases many of the things I know of happened to those lives, but on the other hand, there is no objectivity in the way they report. There's no reasoning behind why something happened. And I think the only way you can make sure that's going to turn out right is if you write an autobiography yourself. On the same lesson token, it's very difficult to go back and relive your life. That must be murder. Even in sort of semi-autobiographical things, when I was writing about my father, the search for my father, it was really tough to go back and go through some of that childhood again. But still, you're driven, knowing that if you don't get it right, and if you're not honest about it, there are people around the woodwork now who are talking about writing biographies of me, and it scares me to death, because I don't want to be involved in it. And by the same token, I know if I'm not involved in it,
they'll get it wrong.
They'll get it wrong. And yet I wouldn't want to censor it. I wouldn't want somebody to pull punches because of me. And also I might find out something about myself. But I think in the end, autobiography is the only way you're going to be able to do it right. I think the ideal thing would be to write an autobiography and not let it go until after you've long gone.
Well, you may be right, but autobiographies are by their very nature self-serving, because the person who writes about himself is going to include certain things that would probably serve his interest. I'm speaking in general terms.
Sure.
For example, if I were to write my autobiography, which would be very, very short, about 2 pages, there were things I would certainly leave out, just because they would embarrass me. And yet there are some people who wear their hearts and their lives on their sleeves. Poets do this, of course, and to a degree you have already. So it would be easier for some people to do that than a more reticent person such as myself.
Well, one of my editors apparently said to a friend of mine, Nan Talese, who was one of my favorite editors in the whole world, and in fact she was my first editor at Random House years ago, had said to somebody that she never thought I would ever write an autobiography because I'd be afraid of hurting people. And I think maybe she was right. My agent said to me, is that true? And I said, well, yes, she said. And she said, well, that's nonsense. She said, I think you'd be more concerned about hurting yourself. And I had to laugh at that, because I think that I am what I am, for good or bad, and at this ripe old age, there's no reason to try to disguise that or whitewash it. I don't think you can. And I've certainly done a lot of things I'm not very proud of, but that would be, to me, the challenge. That would be the only challenge in writing an autobiography, to try to write as honestly as I possibly could, letting the really bad things be there in abundance, as well as the things that you're proud of, but not to brag. I'd like to be able to do it with a sense of humor, because I think that's the least understood aspect of my life. Most of my friends think I'm funny. I think they do. I hope they laugh with me more than at me, but a lot of people think of me, I guess by the nature of the things of mine that have been successful, as being very serious and always wearing my heart on my sleeve and not having a sense of humor about it. And I think, to a great extent, I'm a product of, in many ways, certainly what people like is a product of what they want. I mean, I write songs like Complete Madam Butterfly in a Minute and a Half, and a Champion Charlie Brown, and the Protest Waltz, and things like that. But it's other people who make hits out of Gene and If You Go Away and Seasons in the Sun and Love's Been Good to Me. So they really prefer the ballad things or the more introspective things. I have a poem in the current book called Rembo's Sister, which is a send-up, and yet most people seem to be finding it as a sort of a tragic lament. I write about the fact that friends of mine are stocking up, worrying about the fallout from Chernobyl. And I had somebody say to me, gee, you know, your book is so tragic. You're so worried about Chernobyl. And it was really a passing comment on what's going on now.
Well, that poem struck that person significantly more than the other poems.
I suppose, but I mean, it also proves, I guess, that you really can't. All you can do is write about how you feel, and you certainly have absolutely no idea, and definitely no position or way of knowing how it's going to strike somebody else. I mean, they do read into it what they want to, and you can't tell them how to. In fact, I've read some books where courses on me are included in these books on English and on modern poetry and things. And there was one book I read that was really funny. I never finished it. It was a whole course on my work, and there were multiple choice questions about what I meant by a particular poem, and I failed three questions in a row. And I just never read the rest of the course because I thought, well, if I can't get this, then there's no point in my reading.
Well, I was talking to a poet named Robert Creeley, who writes...
A very fine poet.
Yes. And he had written one, I believe it was two words. It was, "Hear, hear." And I said, "Robert, what does this poem mean, hear, hear?" He said, "I don't know." I just felt like writing it at the time, and I felt moved to say, "Hear, hear." And I wrote that down, and it's now a poem called "Hear, Hear." It's the shortest poem I've ever written.
Well, you know, that is true about poetry. Poetry is really definitely more inspiration than perspiration in a way. If when you get an idea for a poem, if a line doesn't come with the idea, then you should probably reject the idea. You shouldn't sit down and say, "I'm going to write about such and such." It's why I can't understand being a poet laureate. To me, it would be awful to have to sit down and write verses for occasions. I think that would be awful. If somebody's got a birthday, or if I'm told to write a line, I purposely write doggerel because it's more fun. I mean, to do that. Because I can't seriously sit down and say, "Well, I'm going to write something about the Statue of Liberty." If I felt something about the Statue of Liberty at the time, and I did, I mean, all of us were overcome with that. I did write something about it. I didn't publish it or anything, but
I know what you mean. It is a pretentious undertaking.
Yeah, it's strange. It's a strange thing.
This is a momentous occasion in our history. Now I want you to celebrate it in the form of a poem, and you sit there scratching your head.
I think being a poet laureate is a good idea if your job, as it were, is to help turn on other people to poetry and to other poets, not to have them hang on every word you're going to write, but to generally try to raise the standard and the level of literature in your country or whatever. I've had a lot of brickbats from critics and would-be critics who've really dismissed my poetry. And my feeling has always been about that listen, if a line or two of mine turns somebody on to somebody else's work, that's even more important than whether or not they like my things.
Well, your poetry is clear. It's not elusive. It's very accessible. And to some academics, that's a sin. Now, Robert Lowell was a poet that I still like very much, but much of his material is impossible to follow. He writes extremely autobiographically, and there are parts of his poetry that if you don't know his life, you're not going to understand the poetry. So as a result, on a library shelf, you will see all of Robert Lowell's poems. Poetry, by their very nature, comes in very slim volumes. And I would guess that Robert Lowell's poetry will extend maybe a foot.
That's about it, yeah.
But there's a cottage industry that has been built up around Lowell, so you'll have 3 or 4 feet of books about Lowell's poetry and interpreting it. And I just wonder how many people want to sit down and read scholarly studies of Lowell in order to understand his work.
Well, there is a group of people, and Lowell is a really fine poet. But I think that at some point in your own life, you have to decide if you have the gift of writing anything, poetry, prose, music, whatever it may be. I think writers do want to be accessible. I think those people that that say they write only for themselves are liars unless they put it in the filing cabinet and hide it away. How accessible, I guess, is another story. But I don't want people to have to go to a 5-foot bookshelf or to need to be familiar with Alice in Wonderland or to know what I was doing Thursday, December 10th in 1938 to understand what it was I wrote about in 1956. I think that that's wrong, because poetry should be immediate, and it should be accessible, and it should be part of the language. As poets, we're keepers of the language. We should try to steer people away from bastardizing these bastardized words like laundromat and Burger King and things like that, and try to get people into using simple words, words that do communicate, words that can communicate on multiple levels, but by the same token are easily understood. And if we don't do that, then I think we're misusing our gift. At least that's my own personal view.
Well, I think you're right. Your books of poetry are found in almost every bookstore across the country. And I can tell you an interesting story. Last week I had, as a guest, a poet that... I wasn't familiar with her work. She'd written a collection of short stories for Harper and Row, in fact, and her name is Tess Gallagher. And she has published a number of books of poetry, mostly small editions, privately printed. And I had not read her material, so I decided I would go out and buy some copies of her poetry because I wanted to see how she worked as a poet in addition to reading her short stories, which are very, very good. So I went to B. Dalton. There was Rod McEwen, but there was no Tess Gallagher. I went to Scribner's. I went down to the Phoenix. I went to the Gotham. I wound up finding two or three of her books of poetry by calling the Gotham on the phone and talking to the young man in their rare book department who was not in there the day I went to the Gotham, and there was nothing by her on the shelves. So you can't generally walk into a bookstore today and buy a book of poetry by majority of poets, not even Robert Lowell. I dare say if you go to B. Dalton, you will not find a book of poetry by Robert Lowell. You would have to go to a library, perhaps.
And in fact, it's thank God for something like the Book of the Month Club, because the Book of the Month Club has managed to keep Robert Frost collected poetry in print by just offering it all the times in their ads. I don't know how many people buy it. It's hoped that a lot of people do, but certainly a lot more people will be aware of it, because it is displayed there. And I've always hoped that somewhere along the line that one of the publishers I hook up with will allow me to, in fact, I'd take a lesser advance, I'd take a lesser royalty if I were able to hook up with a publisher who would let me bring out once a year a book of poetry by either an unknown poet or a poet who ordinarily doesn't, receive much attention. To let me either edit it or do a forward or do something that might help draw attention to it. And then I would also try to talk to other poets I like who are a little more in the mainstream and see if they might want to do the same thing. Because I think that it's important. I think we can all... It's odd. Now and again we can do without a beefsteak and we can do without a lot of things, but I think we all need the poetry in our lives, whether the poetry comes from just being quiet or being by ourselves, or whether it comes out of music or whether it comes out of a good conversation with somebody, or just walking down the street and seeing how the clouds are arranged in a particular way, or locking eyes with somebody on the street you'll never meet or never meet again or never see again. Those are really sure moments of poetry, and human beings can't do without that. And so I think that the poetry in our lives, is particularly in this age of noise, is in very very short supply and should be in greater demand.
Well, I agree with you. I do feel sometimes art gets short shrift, especially among broadcasters. I know that trying to do a broadcast about poets and novelists, it's a broadcast that I do with Literary Thrust, it's difficult. It is heard on about five or six stations, but some of the CBS stations that should be carrying it don't carry it, but they do carry reports about health, exercise, medicine, consumer affairs, business, sports.
How many books Stephen King has sold?
Well, they don't even do that very much, really. I mean, I sort of staked out King myself to a degree. Even he's a popular writer, but I like
good writer too.
I think he is, and I get flack from it. I get criticism.
Well, you wouldn't have gotten flack, and I'm sure you didn't get any flack until after he became really successful. I mean, I remember there were two newsweeklies, Time and Newsweek, which will remain nameless, who reviewed my work before I started selling in the millions, and just stumbled all over themselves to give me rave reviews. And suddenly, when I was outselling the number one book in hardcover, in both on the fiction list and the nonfiction list, they came down on me so hard that it was tough. And of course, it's fun to have a last laugh, to have a lot of the so-called critics who once really were kind of mean to you now have to teach your work in schools. That's a,
yeah. Well, but, let me tell you a story that may not or may not give you any cheer. Several years ago, perhaps 6 years ago, when William Styron wrote a novel called Sophie's Choice, it was reviewed on the front page of the New York Times Sunday Book Review by a writer named John Gardner, who is now dead. Gardner was also a
very
poet,
good writer.
A very good writer and a poet. His poetry did not have a large circulation, but he was, Gardner, of course, was best known for his novel, Grendel. But Gardner savaged Styron with Sophie's Choice, which went on to become a bestseller and a very fine motion picture. Well, several years later, Styron was here sitting where you are, and he was telling me this story. Outfit in Boston was going to be collecting a series of articles about and essays about Styron, including criticism and reviews. So Styron called Gardner and said, I know that your review was critical of Sophie's Choice, but I wonder if I could have permission to include it in this volume. And Gardner says, you certainly may, but, however, he said, I would like for you to include a postscript, which I will write. And what the postscript says, it will repudiate my review because I now believe that Sophie's Choice is a masterpiece.
Isn't that amazing?
Well, Styron said, why? He says, Styron has never had, he says, a good review in the New York Times. And he just couldn't understand it. Here's a guy who just lambasted that novel and now considers it a masterpiece.
It's amazing. Well, incidentally, my favorite book by Gardner is on how to be an author. How to be a
oh, yes.
Nonfiction.
That's not the title of it, but I know that.
Yeah, it's something about how to write fiction. It's a
the
very, very good book. Something like, yes, it's The Art of Fiction.
I'll call The Art of Fiction.
Excellent book. And I don't happen to agree with it, but I think it's an excellent book, you know.
Well, now, are you talking about the one about how to write? Or are you talking about the essays that he wrote called Moral? I think it's called Moral Fiction.
No, this is a How to. It's a book by it's a book also HarperCollins published.
Yeah, I know that one.
Mm-hmm. In fact, they have a series, I think, by several authors on the mm-hmm. topic. But my own tastes, there are so many authors that I did a television show early. This past year, and it was strange because John Updike was there, and I met him backstage in the green room, and I was speechless. I mean, I like his work so much, and I also like him as a poet, you know. And I don't think many people know he writes poetry, and I could barely talk to him, and I've always regretted that. I mean, but that's not the only time I've been like that. I'm by nature shy around people that I think are really gifted.
Well, Updike is also shy, but he is one of the nicest men you can
hear. He was a nice man, I thought. But I don't know why I didn't just say to him, gee, I love your writing.
I think he would have appreciated that.
It's strange.
Well, do you have room for books? Your house must have quite a few records.
It does. I have a lot of records, and I have a lot of books. At one point, my brother... Elizabeth said to me, Roger, you can collect books, or you can collect records, or you can collect video, but you can't collect books and records and video. Because I like art, too, and I was suddenly taking art off the walls to make more bookshelves and more record shelves. I have thousands and thousands of compact discs. I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of LPs I have, but enough so that they overspill several rooms from floor to ceiling.
I hope you have them cataloged or organized.
I do. I have a whole system of cataloging. And then for CDs, I invented another system, and that's without using a computer. And I'm very far behind already in my CD cataloging. But I know how to get
you catalog all your books on a computer.
No. Not on a computer. I've resisted a computer, but now I really feel I am going to get one. I need it just to file some things out of my head onto something. I think it'll be good for me. I'd like to be more organized, and I think that maybe a word processor.
Oh, I think it's terrific. I have a computer with a file program. It's made by Microsoft File. And because so many of my books, I don't have, living in Manhattan, I don't have room for them. I've had to rent a storage room. And if you cart your books or your records and put them in boxes, books you don't want to get rid of because you'll get out sometime or donate or do something with them, But you'll forget what they are. So I have put them all in a file program.
Oh, that's great.
I can find them by author, by date, by size.
That's
by
fantastic. How long did it take you to do that?
Well, I had to do a lot of catching up 2 years ago when I first got this thing. I had to go through everything. Well, actually, I had kept up on this by using these little notebooks with three-ring binders.
Right.
So for years, I had entered the data almost this size.
But of course, you had no cross-reference.
No cross-reference, but I had entered it just like a library card.
Sure.
At first, I started with cards, these index cards, and they took up too much room. So I wound up with about 14 of these little 3-inch books, so I had most of the data there. But now it's easy. I just type it in, you know, and so...
And you have access. Well, you know, I'll have to send you, just a photo, I'll send you a system I worked out. It's they're long sheets, or long legal-size sheets done on cardboard, and you type them in your typewriter, and then punch them out, and they go on a Rolodex. So I make 5 cards for each composition. Composer, artist, orchestra, conductor, label, and number. And I used to file them by my own numerical system. Now, because I have so many CDs, I now file them by the cataloging system that the record company uses. So I dare say that in the case of some recordings, for instance, I have all the Angel CDs ever released. I have nearly all the Phonogram CDs ever released. I have all the Denons, but 2. So you're talking about
those areas. Missing 2?
Just only 2. Well, I have to go to Japan to get them because they're not released here and nobody imports them. So next trip to Japan, I'll get them. I have a lot of really obscure things. Already there are collector's items on CD. Because a lot of people know that I collect CDs and LPs, a lot of companies send me records, which is wonderful because the cost is extraordinary, and I would certainly not have the kind of album collection I have if I were not a member of NARS, the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences, where every month they send you a list of records, and you can choose whatever you want. And usually I'll say all of the above as far as you're keeping up with this now. Oh, I am. Yes, I'm not keeping up with the catalog too much. My friend and my manager, Wade Alexander, does the typing for me, and the last time I talked to him about typing up the cards, he said, well, the next time I can get into the mood for this. And so I have a stack awaiting his getting into the mood for it, but it's very hard for me to type 5 cards of the same thing in a row. I can write out one, but all I do is think about all the ones that are sitting there that I'm not getting at. And so it's a
I don't have this file program, but if you were to go to a computer system, they have what they call, relational databases. What this means is you can type, you set it up in such a way that you only enter it once, but it also makes additional copies filed any way you want, in effect,
really?
On the computer. So. You can find it almost any way you want, and if you change, say you discard a record or it gets damaged and no longer...
You can call back all those copies.
And all of... Say you're currently making 5 entries, right?
Right.
This will do it automatically. You only enter it one, and it automatically makes the 5 entries. You can find it any way you want. And if you add additional information to it, it will add that to it automatically. You can find it. And it has a search.
Sounds like it's for me.
It has a search to it. I keep a lot of videotape movies. I have maybe 700 movies on videotape, most of which I've recorded from cable. But if I want to find Civil War, or just War, I can just punch in War,
and
I'll do
a
global search, and will register all movies that have anything to do with War. So this is very... It takes a while to do that. That's not index, but there are other movies. But I also have an indexing capability, so by director, I can find director, title, number. So
that's great.
It's a nice thing to do. It takes a while to learn it. It's not for everybody.
Well, in fact, I thought I'll let the Schwann catalog be my reference guide. But then I just went through a situation where I did a discography on CD of Rachmaninoff, and I had 40 more entries than Schwann did, and I had 70 more entries in Gramophone. So, you know, who can I trust? Only me, because I'm the only one who maybe is that interested in Rachmaninoff.
Does your collection must be larger than most public collections.
I guess it is. They say it is.
Have anything like that?
I don't think they do. No, and the thing about my collection, both on CD and on LP, is the fact that it spans all genre. It is predominantly classical, but that certainly the CDs are. But the regular records are everything from heavy metal to pop singers to composers, very heavily on Broadway composers and people like that, folk music, records from all over the world, hard-to-get things, documentary records, spoken word, you name it, musical comedy, films, the works. I mean, if I could find somebody, the ideal thing for me would be to either find a college or university who would come in and catalog the whole thing for me, and let me use it during my lifetime, and then I'd give it to them when I pop off.
That's not the you poet William Hagen. I don't know if you know his work. He has such an arrangement with, the University of Buffalo.
Really?
And he has been collecting poetry since he was in his early 20s, and he just buys, even if he's never heard of the poet.
Well, me too. I mean, I have that's another thing. I have thousands of books of poetry.
And he mails the book off to the poet and has it inscribed. And he's done this with Robert Lowell. When he was a kid, he took his Robert Lowell books up to a stage where Robert Lowell was reading and had Lowell sign these books. So he has thousands and thousands and thousands, which are cataloged. What he has done, though, he's kept possession of the collection, but he's given it to the University of Buffalo, which has put it in a William Hagen room, and they are cataloging it.
That's
and maintaining
fantastic.
It. But he can drive up there. He teaches at another college about 20 minutes away, but he can drive up there anytime he wants.
Well, I'm really looking for that kind of arrangement because, first of all, I live in an old house. I always wonder why I moved in such a house. My house has something like 28 rooms, but I promise you every one of those rooms is used.
Fireproofed, I hope?
Well, it's fireproof to a degree, as fireproof as anything can be. But it worries me, you know, and I don't want to live like that either. I mean, by nature, I'm somewhat of a hermit, and I, especially after being all those years in the public eye, I now stay home a lot. And I would love to get rid of that house and go someplace else. I can make my mortgage every month. It's $850 a month, so that's no big problem.
Well, it must give you a great deal of pleasure knowing that these things that you have collected so lovingly are around you.
Well, they're around me. That gives me a great deal of pleasure, but again, I worry about things like fires. I worry about the fact that I don't seem to have the kind of freedom I want. I don't have the freedom I had when I was a kid. I'd love to be able to just lock a door and go someplace. And it's very hard for me to do that. It's one of the reasons my brother lives with me, is because if I'm off someplace, he stays home. If he's gone somewhere, I stay home. But one of the few people I really have a great deal of pleasure out of, and whom I like a lot, is my brother. And he and I used to have a ball traveling together. And now we don't travel together.
Somebody has to stay home.
Somebody has to stay home. So, I mean, those are real problems. Why we're talking about them on the air, I don't know, but maybe somebody will listen.
Well, but I have to tell you, I just did an interview with the biographer of S.J. Perelman, and he had a large book collection, and he had a home in near New Hope, Pennsylvania. And when his wife died, he sold everything. He had antiques, he had art, he sold everything. Moved to London with just his suitcases, effectively. London, he didn't like, so he came back and moved into the Gramercy Park Hotel in Manhattan, which is where he died. And it was a very lonely death because he didn't have anything. He had nothing around him, and he was quoted as saying he regretted disposing of all of his things. It would have been nice for him to have had these things around him at the time of his death, but he didn't. He lived in a hotel room.
Wonderful thing. I mean, that is a thing that... I think while sometimes our possessions do take possession of us, it is very comforting for me to have not only three or four different editions over the years of the Grove catalog to go to when I want to know something, Grove Dictionary to go to when I want to know something, but to have isolated issues of the Schwann catalog from the time they began to go back and look and see if my memory is really correct, if so-and-so did record Beethoven's third in such and such a year. Those things are important to me. And also other things to do with, that have absolutely nothing to do with music. And also I've collected over the years a lot of letters, important letters of people. Nothing upsets me more than to be in a town traveling, whether it's in this country or another one, doing a concert and going to a small bookstore and see, letters by a famous poet or an author just sitting there rotting, and nobody caring about them, and so I load them up and ship that trunk back home. And I mean, I have boxes and boxes of things I haven't even opened. I mean, to that extent, I have been a pack rat, and I'm at the point where I just don't know what to do about it. And obviously, a university should have it, because these things should belong to the public, and there should be an area where people, where somebody can go and find out about a person. I mean, I have a lot of things on Rachmaninoff's life. I have a lot of things on Auden's life. I have a lot of things on many obscure people's lives, other people that I just cared about. I have a wonderful Walt Whitman collection.
Well, you'll find a way to direction that collection, but I wouldn't be in any hurry.
Well, I got to do something, because I'm getting an itch to just be able to walk away a bit, you know.
Well, we're almost out of time. It's really great talking to you. I did have to ask you, you're no longer singing, are you?
I am. But just for myself. I take lessons with a wonderful singer and a coach named Jerry Southern, who's a great singer, and I sing all the time. I can't imagine not doing it, but I don't sing in public, except once in a while I might do it for Jerry or something like that, or for a special evening. I'm thinking of maybe doing something in the coming year, but it would have to be an event of some kind. There'd have to be a reason for it. Maybe I'll come out and do it and record the whole evening as a digital album or something. I've never recorded
digitally. Do you miss those old folk music days?
I do, to a degree. I don't miss some of the things that went with them. I miss some of the rap sessions afterward, but I don't miss the waking up in strange towns and the never seeing the city you went to and the tremendous demands of going into a city and having to do interviews and things in one city to assure you had a full house in the next city, in the next state, or 3 weeks from now, or a month from now, or whatever. Or to go and... I love the idea of going and doing a lecture on a campus, but I think it's miserable for an author afterward to have to go to a literary tea with the faculty. Because most of them are, you know, that whole thing you have to go through, you know, listening to all their problems. I guess I should be more tolerant of that, but I'm much more interested in the students than I am in the academic life problems. Although over the years I've become more concerned about the academics, because I don't think we have enough schools, and we're not attracting enough teachers, and our schools aren't good enough. And that's because we aren't attracting teachers and paying them enough money, just as we're not paying our cops enough money and our firemen and all of people.
What about us journalists?
Definitely journalists. One of the tragic things about journalism has been the demise of newspapers, the demise of radio journalism, because of the quick fix journalism on television. And I think whether television news has to compete with Wheel of Fortune or not, it still should be an hour. I'd rather watch Dan Rather for an hour on television.
We've all said that should.
I'm sure he'd rather do an hour show.
It's appalling.
But the networks don't want to do that.
CBS News has 22 minutes at 6 o'clock to cover the world.
Well, it's appalling when CBS, NBC, and ABC feel that they have to compete with their newscasts, as well as worrying about what leads into the newscast, what follows them, that the stations around the country can pressure them, as Los Angeles recently pressured CBS News into putting Dan Rather's newscast on a half hour earlier so that it would coincide with NBC's newscast and it wouldn't hit, and I'm saying this on a CBS station, I'm mindful of that, and so that it wouldn't have to compete with Wheel of Fortune. But it's to ABC's credit.
Let's not get going.
They've still stuck Peter Jennings there at 7 o'clock.
And, as a loyal CBS employee for the last 20 years, like most CBS people, we all have our views about how our company should operate.
Well, I mean, I'm you know, I mean, I say this, and you know, I'm sorry. I'm very sorry to NBC, and I'm very sorry to ABC, but I have watched Dan Rather for a long, long time. I think there's so much bad news today that it comes down to a situation of who do you want and who do you trust to tell you the bad news? And in my case, it's Dan Rather. So it bothers me. His career bothers me. If he gets beat up on Park Avenue, it's like me getting beat up. If his program seems to lose ratings, it's like me losing ratings. Because
and
I want to say
that, you know. You also feel strongly. You have a poem here called Radio, which is dedicated to Charles Osgood.
That's right.
He would have been here yesterday had you been here yesterday.
He doesn't know about this yet, I don't think.
He doesn't know about it?
No, I'll send him a book one of these days. But
yeah,
Dan was in the last book, and I never sent him a copy of the book, although I do know that his wife, Jean, has collected some of my books, which makes me very happy.
But Jean, she used to be a writer with us with this
I didn't know that.
Southern. She used to sit right out here, and she would shout, headlines, headlines, coming, headlines.
Is she from Texas as well?
She is not from Texas. She is from the Deep South. And, however, and she had the most lovely Southern accent. She wrote, I believe, for Associated Press. But now she is in the guise of a housewife. And so I think they've had four kids.
That's a lot.
Since they got married.
That's tough.
They moved out to Bergen County. Well, Rod McEwen, like your poetry, you're an accessible guy and very interesting, and we could just go on forever, I know, but I know you have other things to do. It's a delight being able to talk to you. I really appreciate the fact that you took the time out to come in.
Well, it's my pleasure. I thank you for giving me so much time, and I love the fact that we talked about a lot of things other than, quote, the book, end quote, because to me... conversation is a pretty rare thing.
Well, you listen to KNX, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Los Angeles. Well, I understand. If you listen long enough, you'll catch BookBeat. I think they run it on the overnight, but it's only about books.
Well, I listen to KNX much more now that they've changed the format back again.
They're more all newsy now?
We've had a lot better change for a while. They were very heavy into to rock and rock news.
And, rock news?
Yeah.
Are we talking about the AM or the FM?
We're talking about the AM. As well as
what's
the,
rock news?
Oriented to those little punchy, I call it rock news because it's all headlines,
oh.
No features. So to me, that's rock news.
I thought they were doing a lot of talks, you know, with chefs.
They are now. Now they're like now, but they had a time period for about an 8 month period where they did a complete switch around. It wasn't quite as bad as what we've just gone through on television out there, where we had 20-minute newscasts. I don't know if you knew about that.
I did, in fact.
It was a scandal.
A former boss of mine, Neil Darrow, lost his job because of that. He and Frank Gardner, who was the news director at KCBS TV.
Well, I wouldn't want to call names, but anybody who was dumb enough to think that sort of thing would work, I can't imagine them keeping their jobs.
It didn't. I mean, what happened was the ratings went down drastically, and somebody, the management here in New York,
he sent somebody out,
told Darrow, he said, you've got to get rid of the management out there in, at KCBS-TV. And Darrow said, no, I won't do that. I mean, I've committed myself to that format. I'm supporting the management there. We've got to give it more time. And they wouldn't give him more time.
What was really wrong with it was that there was no identification. You like to identify, I think, with people. You like sort of a home-based feel, and there wasn't. One of the good things they did is they brought over from ABC Radio, they brought over Michael Jackson, and that interview was a terrific interview. That was a good interview.
Yeah, he does a network radio show.
Yes,
I've
he does.
Here
and so
he's
an outstanding interview, and it was great to see him on television. He had very unusual people. I mean, he had LaRouche on and all kinds of, you know, oddball people. And so that part was interesting. But some of the other stuff was, it wasn't just soft news. It was just boring. You couldn't get any news. And so they've gone back now, and that's really nice to hear. But in the meantime, Jess Marlowe left, and so he's about to pop up at NBC, and that's a pity because he used to be the lead to Rather, and so now there's...
Well, you're obviously very attuned to the things around you. I think we all become attached to the things that we rely on for information. For example, when the New York Times changes its format...
Oh, it drives me nuts.
I get furious.
Well, how do you think I feel? When I come into New York City, I get the New York Times, but in California, I get it every day, but it's the at-large edition or whatever, And Wade sends me all the music reviews, because we get about a third of them out there. We don't get all those different section. We don't get sports.
You probably don't get the ads.
Whatever. We don't get any of the ads.
You know,
the ads are very important.
The ads, I mean, I used to pick up the New York Times on vacation. I still pick it up when I go on vacation, but sometimes it's some sort of truncated edition, and the ads are
It's terrible.
There.
That at-large edition is awful. It'll drive you to USA Today.
Well, I don't know about
driving.
That.
That's a lot of driving, but it'll
that's
do it.
That's an interesting
It's
paper.
Interesting paper, because what they've done is they've given you a television newspaper is what they've done.
Yeah, they really have, but it's colorful.
It's an interesting, it's a lot of newspapers are surviving by copying them now.
Yeah.
Strange. But I still miss the old newspaper. I still miss, I miss radio. I wish that, I still listen to, you know, I still listen to the Powder Milk. I call it the Powder Milk Biscuit Hour, but you know the 2 hours of Prairie Home Companion.
Oh, that's a terrific show.
Because it's live radio, and that's nice.
Now I've had Garrison Keillor in here twice.
Is he an interesting man?
He is very difficult man to talk to. He's not like you. He is a Minnesotan. He is very reticent.
Really?
And I could ask him a question, and he's got rather strange mannerisms, if you've ever seen him on television.
Yeah, I have.
And
he ponders.
He ponders, you know, and his mouth screws up, and his eyes go off, and there would be long pauses. And he's funny, or maybe he thinks he's supposed to be funny, because he thinks a long time before he answers. He is a kind of a difficult interview, actually. Now, he's not spontaneous. He is very much like he is on radio, in fact.
Well, it's so funny, because I have people coming to me all the time asking me if I want to do television, and I say, no, but if you can ever find a radio show for me to do, I would love to be on radio. And they say, radio? You know,
what's
it's as though you're talking.
Well, why? A Prairie Home Companion would be a wonderful vehicle for you.
It would be fun. You know, it would be fun to do a show like that, that is different. Maybe it came from California or something. Because California,
I don't think there are any.
Are
there? There's none here in New York.
None. And that's a pity. There's room for it, I think. I don't know.
Well, I know that the BBC is running programs that would never run here, and they're still running drama, comedy.
They are, and interesting stuff.
But, of course, that's done by the government, so
yes.
They don't care whether people listen or want it. They will do it anyway. And since we don't do that in this country, there's no market for it.
No, and you wonder if, I suppose, really radio in this country, particularly AM radio, concentrates on news and traffic.
We do. We do here. This is CBS has, most of CBS's radio stations are all news across the country, all of the ONOs, except for the FM stations. And that's all we do is
news, sports,
news,
and traffic.
Traffic, business, and we stick in BookBeat 3 times a day.
Well, that's not
Believe it or not, we do a book report. I hate to say book report. It sounds like I'm in the sixth grade.
Not bad.
But actually, it's on 20 times a week, 7 days a week here in New York. So it's because this is the publishing capital, and so I got them interested in it, and I keep it short and tight.
That's great.
So we stick it in between the business and the sports and the traffic. Rod McEwen, thank you very much.
My pleasure, and thanks again. I hope we can do it again sometime.
I hope so, too.